It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by on-camera and voiceover talent rodhunter.com and the law offices of Matthew Simone. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist Bob Siegel.
We're all familiar with the phrase cat fight. I should be honest, it's somewhat of an unfair phrase. It has to do with women that are fighting, sometimes physically, sometimes verbally, and they sound like cats with their claws and their meows. Meow. To be fair, men get into stupid squabbles as well. It can probably be argued that there is a difference in the sexes, a difference in the way they deal with conflict. Probably a ridiculous male fight and a ridiculous female fight are different in nature, but they're both dumb. Let's say that from the onset. However, why am I bringing this up? We had in Congress quite an exchange between Democrats and Republicans, mostly from Republican Marjorie Greene and occasionally from other Republicans, but she was taking on a lot of Democrats. And I have to say, it at least looked like and sounded like the stereotypical catfight. Again, we don't need to call it that, but for those who talk about catfights, it sure looked that way, but whatever you want to call it. And if you don't want to call it a catfight, I totally understand. Whatever you want to call it, it really degenerated fast. It certainly was not a bright gold star day for our House of Representatives. How did this all begin? This was a committee that was going to come up with a resolution to bring before the entire House of Representatives to vote. The issue at hand was a contempt of Congress resolution for Attorney General Merrick Garland over his failure to cooperate with a subpoena regarding the handing over of the audio recording of President Biden's interview with Special Counsel Robert Hur. You might remember that in that interview, Biden couldn't remember when he was vice president. The guy came to the conclusion that he was guilty about the documents, but that he was so senile that he probably shouldn't be brought before a jury because the jury would feel sorry for him. Another whole story. But anyway, Merrick Garland, part of our weaponized justice system, was not going to cooperate and hand this over. In the meantime, President Trump is on trial, a criminal trial in New York, over supposed election fraud, and yet the prosecution can't even name the charge. So there was some hypocrisy here that Republican Representative Marjorie Greene wanted to bring up. So she asks this question, and it was a very good question. I'd like to know if any of the Democrats on this committee are employed Judge Merchant's daughter. Now, Judge Merchant is the judge overseeing the New York case against Trump. His daughter does a lot of work for the Democratic Party. He himself has donated to Biden. He's an extremely biased judge. We've talked about this before. So what Green's trying to do is extend the idea of the lawfare going on against Republicans, particularly Donald Trump, but a lot of other Republicans. So while we're trying to decide whether or not to issue this contempt of Congress resolution, which the Democrats don't want to issue and the Republicans do, she's asking about another case. How many of you Democrats are employing the judge's daughter on this other case? That was a fair question. Unfortunately, the question never got answered. Democratic Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett said, "What does that have to do with Merrick Garland?" And then in a derogatory way, she asked Green, "Do you know what we're here for?" Green responded, "I don't think you know what we're here for. I think your fake eyelashes are messing up what you're reading." Then Jamie Raskin, the Democratic ranking member, said, "That's beneath even you, Miss Green." At which time, squad member Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez just lost it. "That is absolutely unacceptable. How dare you attack the physical appearance of another person?" Green then mocked Cortez. "Are your feelings hurt?" Cortez says, "Oh, girl, baby girl, don't even play." Oh, really? Green says, baby girl? I don't think so. Now, later on, this Republican lawmaker from Georgia, Marjorie Green, did agree to have her words stricken, but that wasn't enough for Cortez. Cortez demanded an apology. Green said, I am not apologizing. And then she said, why don't you debate me? Well, I think that's pretty self-evident, Cortez said. Yeah, I think it's self-evident, too. She would lose the debate. This woman is not the sharpest tool in the shed. Of course she's not going to debate Green. If it was a real debate, I don't mean a debate with CNN and MSNBC moderators taking on Green, but a real debate where they were talking to each other, she wouldn't stand a chance. It would be messy. And essentially, Green said that. Yeah, you don't have enough intelligence. Then Crockett came back in. She said, I'm just curious to better understand your ruling. If someone on this committee then starts talking about somebody's bleached blonde, bad built, butch body, that would not be engaging in personalities, correct? So that, of course, was a derogatory remark aimed at Green to pay her back. At this point, chairman of the panel, James Comer, looked very confused. And you should see the footage of this. The men just don't know what to do with the women going at it. He says, a what now? And then he says, I have no idea what you just said. Then Representative Anna Polina, a Republican from Florida, said, calm down to Crockett. And then Crockett says, don't you tell me to calm down because you all talk noise and then you can't take it. Because if I come down and talk, and then she used the S word. If I come down and talk S about her, y'all gonna have a problem. Well, a session from a panel in Congress. Our tax dollars hard at work. Okay, let me make a few comments. First of all, the remark, the question that got this started that came from Green. I saw this all on TV, but when you go through the periodicals, when you go through the newspapers and reports and you do an internet search, most of them don't quote her question that got things started. Her question about how many people here are employing the daughter of the judge in the New York case. Instead, they just say that Marjorie Greene, a right-wing Trump supporter, made a derogatory remark, or they just omit that part of it. So they jump into the catfight, but they don't talk about how it actually got started. Now, I think Green was asking a very legitimate question. She should have stopped there. The eyelashes remark, it was cruel, it was unnecessary, and just from a practical point of view, putting the ethics aside, I don't think she should have said it anyway, but from a practical point of view, after she threw out that eyelash remark, they never got back to the question. And the only report was this catfight, so-called. That's really ironic. However, I mostly want to respond to Cortez. She was absolutely livid over this eyelash remark. And yes, I agree, Green shouldn't have made the remark. But let's have a little perspective. Let's look at the things that do not concern squad member Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. We have open borders. And some of the people most recently apprehended on the San Diego border weren't even from Mexico. A lot of them were from Afghanistan. A lot of them were from Iran. Some are from Pakistan. Some are from China. This doesn't concern her. People can go into stores and steal up to $1,000 worth of goods without being prosecuted. That doesn't concern her. For most cases in New York, you're released without bail. That doesn't concern her. The police are being defunded. That doesn't concern her. We have a presidential candidate going through a criminal trial with a charge that can't even be stated, overseen by a judge who gave money to Biden and who allows the key witness of the defense to be interrupted every single minute and threatens him with contempt of court just for staring at him the wrong way. That doesn't concern her. She refers to Israel as a country guilty of genocide when all Israel is doing is defending herself from an attack on October 7th. Babies were put into ovens. That doesn't concern her. Parents were killed in front of kids. That doesn't concern her. Children were killed in front of parents. That doesn't concern her. Women were raped. That doesn't concern her. A fellow congresswoman makes a derogatory remark about somebody's eyelashes. That concerns her. And this is Bob Siegel making the obvious obvious.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-aged child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
To 1170 AM, 96.1 FM, The Answer. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. I'd like to welcome two special guests. First, Scott Wingerter, who has been on our program before, an Air Force veteran, history teacher, and successful podcaster. Scott is joined tonight by a friend of his and colleague of his to talk about a television project they are doing together. Nick Langan is a screenwriter, author, and founder of Sixpence Productions, a long lover of storytelling. Nick left a stable career in police work in order to pursue the creation of quality entertainment that reflects his values. Gentlemen, welcome to our program.
Thanks so much, Bob, for having us.
Oh, it's great having you. Boy, I'm just thinking, wow, the police and the military, two of the most important and dangerous professions, and yet right now, television has become a priority for both of you. I have to assume that's because the bad messaging in our media needs to be replaced by better morals, or maybe the nation you've been protecting all these years will continue its state of decline. Is that somewhere in the neighborhood of your reason for getting passionate about television these days?
100%, Bob. This is Scott. So thanks again for having us. We really appreciate it and we're excited to be on. And just to sort of piggyback off of what you were just saying in your opening monologue there, the idea here is you can see the decline of America in the fact that we're incapable of electing statesmen to Congress anymore. That goes for both Marjorie Taylor Greene and AOC and Representative Crockett. The fact that that broke out in the halls of our Congress demonstrates the absolute decline of America. The fact that congressmen are incapable of acting with a shred of decorum anymore, unfortunately, demonstrates what the founders have always said. In order to have a republic, you have to have a virtuous people. And if you're incapable of having a shred of decorum in the halls of Congress, then I don't see any other demonstration other than the fact that that clearly illustrates that that's exactly where America is. And I think that's pretty much why we're doing what we're doing here. Because Nick and I have both, as you've noted, we volunteered to serve. Me in the military, Nick as a police officer, to serve and protect our country. And decline is imminent. And something needs to be done. And that's why we're up to what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, I want to talk about the specific project you're on, but first for some background, could you each in turn comment on the state of Hollywood today? I mean, the Hollywood with the Hollywood sign that's in Los Angeles, because I think there was a golden age of Hollywood. I think there were some wonderful movies made in Hollywood over the years. Not as much recently, occasionally. I don't want to generalize too much, but could you comment on the state of Hollywood today?
Sure, I'd be happy to take this one. And we'll have to get together afterwards and write down the transcript of that fight that made up the opening monologue. I feel like that would be really good in maybe a slapstick comedy or something we can put together. But I'd say there was definitely, I mean, everybody knows that there's been a decline in Hollywood, and there's a bunch of factors. I mean, from a practical aspect, the virus of unknown and unspecified origin certainly had an effect on the movie industry, and I think put a hurting on, not necessarily for the worse, but at least the past 30 years, it's been a gradual process building up of just sort of very obvious indoctrination into movies, starting out slowly, and then part of it is they stopped producing a lot of independent features and really were relying on these big tentpole things that then they would cram nonsense into. And, you know, we saw some pushback on it with things like Top Gun Maverick absolutely crushing at the box office. And it was a pro-America, like, classic throwback film, and it did very well. But unfortunately, those things have become rarer and rarer. And instead of presenting interesting questions or things to get you thinking, you know, adult films that are like giving you situations that are you have to stop and think about after you watch or talk about, and you're like, oh man, that really presented something interesting, or even just giving you sort of mindless entertainment. I think a majority of the stuff coming out now is just beating you over the head with this sort of leftist message that we're all really tired of.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can both respond to this.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with everything that Nick has said. To me, what I see out of Hollywood, and I think you're absolutely right in saying that there was a golden age of Hollywood, and I'd like to juxtapose what that looked like compared to what we have nowadays. You know, when you have people that were making films that, you know, just think about like Superman, the classic Superman of the 1980s, where he stood for truth, justice, and the American way. And then when they come out with the Superman movies in the early 2000s...
Yeah, they dropped the American way, didn't they? Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And that's where we're starting from, I think, was really the first outright, obvious turn down that path of destruction in the Hollywood system. They used to have to pretend in the 1990s, you know, even if they weren't 100% on board with that golden age of Hollywood, the truth, justice, American way, they pretended, at least in the 90s, and they started to lose that, I think, in the 2000s, the early 2000s. And you see how it's become so obvious now that they're just beating America over the head with their messaging. And that is just not a recipe for good literature. I'm somewhat of a classicist, and literature is a very important aspect of a society and a culture. And what I see is when you start putting your messaging before the story, that's a recipe for disaster. And I think that's exactly where we've landed in our modern day.
So you feel that even something that has a good message, that good message should not get in the way of the story either?
I don't have a problem with something that's good. I think goodness, especially in any great work of literature, whether that's Dante's Divine Comedy or Chaucer's Canterbury Tales or even something like Star Wars, the Republic, you know, let's use Star Wars. You're rooting for the Republic. The Empire is evil, right? A fun little point there. The good guys in Star Wars are Republicans.
I wouldn't explain that to George Lucas. He may have the values that we believe in the movie, but he thinks he has other values when he talks. These guys, when they talk off screen, are just different people.
Yeah.
Right.
But Spielberg, too.
But they had to have that element. Otherwise, that movie in the 1976 when that came out, that wouldn't have sold in America.
Oh, of course, because they have a conscience. They have a conscience that God gave them, but they also want to get along with all their Hollywood peers. So it's like a subtle form of brainwashing. It's like an Emperor's New Clothes phenomenon.
That's one of my favorite words. I'm so glad you use that. Conscience, Latin, con, with, science, knowledge. If you have a guilty conscience, you're guilty with the knowledge that what you're doing is wrong. And yeah, so he has to put Star Wars in that context. There has to be a bad guy. There has to be a good guy. And, you know, I love the fact that Darth Vader is redeemed in Return of the Jedi. That's a great story.
Spoiler alert.
For the 12 people in the country that don't know, I thought the most chilling line in the Star Wars movies was in Revenge of the Sith. This is how democracy dies, with thunderous applause.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they got that part right. But that's back when they had to pretend, at least, to be American, to embrace at least what liberalism used to stand for.
Yeah, liberalism was not originally a bad thing. It was somebody who thought outside the box, who pushed the envelope. Those that call themselves liberals today are not doing that at all. They're just marching in lockstep.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I always differentiate between a liberal and a leftist.
Absolutely.
You know, like somebody like Bill Maher, I probably won't agree with how we should do things, but Bill Maher and I at least can agree that like something like freedom of speech is a good thing, that democracy and voting for your own representatives is a good thing, things like that.
Did you see him on the Greg Gutfeld show the other night?
I didn't catch that, no.
It was really something to behold. They were getting along because they don't believe in censorship and they believe people should be able to address their differences civilly. Unfortunately, Maher still likes to talk about how Trump won't concede elections and he wouldn't respond to Gutfeld saying, what about the fact that for the last 8 years, Hillary hasn't conceded either? And he just conspicuously would not respond to that.
Well, I would note that every time that there's been a Republican elected since George W. Bush, the Democrats have objected to the election.
Of course. And if Trump wins this next time, we know that they're going to object and say that it was a false election, of course. But when the other side does, insurrectionists, they're election deniers. They just take what they do and they project it on others.
That's exactly the line that they're going to go with, is he's ineligible because of the 14th Amendment and the third clause of the 14th Amendment.
Oh, they're already talking about not certifying the election should he win, which means they're probably realizing that their ability to cheat this time may be waning.
Right. Well, that's what they do. This is the thing about the leftists, right? They are constantly moving the goalposts. And they're always accusing other people of the crimes for which they are plainly guilty of.
Also, what they deny today, they admit and revel in tomorrow. A number of years ago, when Obama was president, if anybody suggested that he had socialist tendencies, the Democrats were quick to say that's unfair, that's derogatory. And now they love socialism. They brag about it. They revel in it. Right now, they won't admit that they cheated in the last election. But I'm looking toward the day where they not only admit it, but brag and say, well, of course, this was another Hitler. Of course we cheated. Wouldn't you cheat to keep Hitler? You just watch. Mark my words. They will admit that someday.
Well, they already did that. I think it was a Times Magazine article that came out saying exactly how they were going to do that right after the 2020 election and how the plan worked flawlessly. They have already admitted it.
But if the Republicans admit it, they should go to jail and be accused of insurrection.
Correct. Yes. You know, rules for thee, but not
the
me.
Consistency of our times. Well, speaking of all of this and getting back to Hollywood, your view of the woke cancel culture.
It's bad. No. I would say we've seen a big problem, obviously, with that. And we know, for example, that certain awards are no longer given out to films unless they meet certain diversity quotas.
Oh, yeah. You can't get an Oscar anymore without just going through and checking off the boxes.
Yeah, which means when I go to make my historically accurate Viking movie, it better be diverse through racial and gender lines.
I hate to break this to you, but I don't think your movie is going to stand a lawyer's chance in hell at the Oscars.
Yeah, probably not. So it's definitely bad. I think one of the things that Scott was alluding to when he brought up putting message before story, the trick is infusing a story with your views in a natural way that raises questions and brings discussion, I think. So, for example, I read a very good book, a fantasy book, a couple years ago, and the author was clearly stating some things. Like, the author clearly has said in interviews that he believes in certain, say, racial disparities in the United States that I would disagree exist. But the book was so well written, and that was crafted into a part of the story that I was willing to read it and allow it, if that makes sense. He wasn't beating me over the head with whatever. I think we've seen some effort on the conservative side now, slowly, trying to make some alternative media finally starting to realize the importance of culture. But it's tricky because you don't want to do the same thing that the left is doing, right? And I would say the same thing for anything. So if I make a movie that's Christian, I don't necessarily want to beat the audience over the head with my Christian message. If I make a movie that stems from conservative values, I don't want to beat the audience over the head with that, because then I'm just guilty of doing the same thing and creating poor art. even though I have maybe messages or ideals in it that we would all agree with.
Yeah, in fact, I was going to ask each of you about the history of Christian films. Now, much as I've liked their messages, I would say that originally, and now I'm talking about back in the 70s and 80s when they were very popular, some of those Christian films were just embarrassingly bad. And even though I'm a big Billy Graham fan, Billy Graham and Franklin Graham are just about the only televangelists I've ever liked. But in a Billy Graham movie, sometimes you'd have some good acting and good writing, but it always ended the same. Somebody went home, turned on the TV, Billy Graham was preaching, then somebody came out at the end. I feel that some of the films that we've had in the last 5 to 10 years have been better. And I wanted to get the two of you to comment on that.
I think probably the best example of that, and I don't think it's a perfect example, and I don't want to be overly critical of it, I did rather enjoy large portions of it, was Nemesis, if people have
Nefarious.
Seen that. That was, I'm sorry, Nefarious. My apologies. Nefarious, written by Steve Deese.
Is that the one about the guy in the jail cell that was demon-possessed?
Yeah.
I saw that. Boy, that was intense, but very well done.
It was fantastic through most of it, but I think they fell into that trap at the end. It
got on the soapbox a little too much.
Yeah, so it wasn't as obvious as Billy Graham giving an altar call at the end of the movie, but I didn't like the ending. I think it was a little bit over the top, and it was a little bit beating the audience over the head. And I don't know that that was necessary. I think if you had just wrapped it up in a more natural way, I think it would have landed better. But I am excited to see that we are, as conservatives, trending that way, because that is 100% what we need to do. Conservatives. Why do we call ourselves conservatives? Well, because we try to conserve our culture, right? We've done a very bad job at that over the years.
Not the least of which is the name conservative. The first project should be to find a better name.
Maybe.
I mean, the word liberal doesn't really describe liberals anymore. I think you can say the same thing about the word. I have a friend named Everett Piper. He wrote a book with the best title I've ever heard. It was called Why I Am a Liberal and Other Conservative Ideas. The title just speaks for itself, what was in that book.
That's perfect. You know, when my students ask me as a history teacher, you know, what my political leanings are, I always tell them I'm a constitutional conservative and a classical liberal. And then I leave it up to them to go figure out what that means. But what are we conserving? We've ceded everything. We've conceded the arts, the culture, the media, the news.
The whole education system.
K through 12 education, the universities. I mean, what are we conserving? And the stupidest thing is why we're doing what we're doing, why we left good jobs that provided stability for our families, is we took this oath, whether it was for me in the military or Nick as a cop, to maintain our society. And we are losing that rapidly. And the most effective tool in the tool bag is to literally make stories and use storytelling to convey these messages to the audience. And so that's why we're so passionate about what we're trying to do here. And I'm excited to get into that here in a moment. But I think it's important to set this up as to why we're doing what we're doing and how valuable it is. Society has always been maintained by things like literature and art and architecture, and speaking as a classicist, the whole idea of truth, beauty, and goodness. And we've basically just gone hands off on that and have given Hollywood the complete ability to do whatever they want. And we haven't made a peep except for in the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. And so if we're going to be effective in conserving our culture and our values and maintaining our virtue, that's the kind of stories that we need to be creating as conservative filmmakers. And I think that's the most effective way of maintaining our culture today.
Okay, well, in that vein, we're anxious to hear about what your current project is. We'll talk about that when we return. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
Bob Siegel's novels may start out looking like typical stories, but in no time at all, they go directions you would never have dreamed about. Just listen to the premise of Bob Siegel's unusual story, Choice of the Lorelei. Martha Flannery, an aggressive missionary, sets out for the Frisian Islands to convert the newly discovered tribe called Reinu. Here she enters into a strong battle of wills with Dr. Connors, a cultural anthropologist who wants to protect the Reinu people from outside influence, especially evangelism. Connors' strange manners and obsession with the Reinu are only the first of several eerie mysteries, including previous visitors to the island who never returned home and an elderly gentleman claiming to be 4,000 years old. Choice of the Lorelei, available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
This is Bob Siegel. As a Christian apologist, I hear scorning and ridicule all the time from Bible skeptics and unbelievers. Some churches will still respond to such people with love and understanding. Others do not.
You Christians are such morons. There's no proof that God exists, and only a pea brain would believe in miracles. Wake up! Step into the 21st century. Besides, Christianity is responsible for most of the world's problems.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Relax, my friends. That's not the kind of response you'll get from Skyline Church. We welcome you just as you are, with all your doubts, all your questions, and all your concerns. Your problems with religion are understandable, and I promise at Skyline you'll experience the love of Jesus Christ, not the revenge of a Sith Lord.
Skyline Church.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. Our theme, Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture, by special guests Scott Wingerter and Nick Langan. They are involved in a special television product. Okay, we've laid the groundwork. We've talked about the state of Hollywood as it is, as we want it to be. What is this new program in the works, guys?
Scott. No, I'll take it. We are working on a miniseries, at least to start, it's a miniseries, an 8-episode, 1-hour pop series called In the Shadow of High Places. And it is a supernatural thriller that has strong themes of spiritual warfare, the pro-life movement, and free will and redemption all wrapped up, as well as some pretty fantastical action and almost fantasy elements as well.
And you do have actor Kevin Sorbo signed up so far, correct?
We do. We have actually several people that we're working on being attached that have letters of intent going out. But Kevin Sorbo is the big one. He and his son are playing the same character, but different points. So Kevin's character, Jack, is a Vietnam veteran. And then we have Braden Sorbo attached to play Jack in Vietnam. So that's pretty cool.
And do they look similar enough that it looks like the same person?
I think so, yeah. We spent some time looking at pictures, comparing, but yes, which is one of the reasons we thought it would be such a great fit. And Braden has done some acting. He was in the most recent Left Behind movie and a few other things, but much like us, and we appreciate this about Kevin and him as well, he sort of knew right from the get that he wasn't going to have a successful Hollywood career because he wasn't willing to keep his mouth shut about certain things, say, or go along to get along. And so we wanted to work with them from the start. When we first started talking about doing this project, actually, it came up several times. And then as God willed it, we were able to get in touch with them.
Was Kevin a Christian back when we first became familiar with him, back in the days of Hercules, or were those his pre-Christian days?
I believe that he was definitely conservative, because I know he's talked before about getting kind of in trouble at towards the end of Hercules and then doing other things. I'm not sure faith-wise. I think he's kind of always been a Christian. I don't know how seriously he was taking it back then, but...
Well, he's sure taking it seriously now. That's the important thing.
Well, for sure. And that's really the important issue here, right? So, like, going back to what I was saying in the previous section, it's the 1990s into the early 2000s where you really start to see that switch in Hollywood. And Kevin Sorbo, Hercules, had one of the most popular TV shows on the planet at the time. And then after Hercules, he goes on to the, Andromeda?
Yeah.
And then after that, all of a sudden, he just can't get any work, right? And why? Well, because he's an outspoken conservative and he has moral principles and he has this Christian faith and he's not willing to compromise on those principles. And so no one will work with him and he can't get a job in Hollywood anymore. That's absurd. If you're really this great star, you have one of the most popular TV shows of the decade and all of a sudden now you can't get any work and you're blacklisted, that's absurd. And so when we first started out on this journey, what we're really trying to do other than make this TV show, one of our long-term goals is to make an alternative, a conservative, traditional American values alternative to Hollywood. I was joking. I was like, man, it'd be great if we can get Kevin Sorbo because like he's like the poster child of what we're trying to do here. And then lo and behold, as God willed it, we get Kevin Sorbo and we were just over the moon on that.
Now, you've told us a little bit. I know that obviously in a TV series, you want people to have the story unfold a bit at a time. But I also know that you're raising funds for this. So you have to whet people's appetite. How much can you tell us about the story? Totally up to you, what you need to refrain from saying, but what you also want to say to kind of sell it, so to speak.
Sure. I broke it down and we have four main storylines. And really the goal, what we're trying to do quality-wise is we want this to be the kind of show that if you turned on HBO, while we wouldn't put certain things into our show because of our values, but quality-wise, I'm talking acting, writing, camera work, all that, action, we want this to feel like it could fit right at home on one of those serious streaming networks. But the main thrust of the story focuses around these two sisters that are sort of grown up and gone different paths, and one of whom is a scientist and a mother and sort of a traditional evangelical Christian, and the other of whom has totally gone off the rails, parties it up, becomes very involved with a sort of Planned Parenthood type organization. And so they're sort of our main human protagonists. Their father is Kevin Sorbo. And so the second storyline is sort of tying some of these themes of life and death into his service in Vietnam and what I think are some really cool and interesting ways. I've always been a fan of shows that sort of cover generations or multiple decades, this sort of long interweaving story. And then we have our third storyline, which covers a group of undercover journalists that are investigating the black market sale of organs. I'll leave it to the listeners to figure out how that ties in with abortion and the pro-life movement, but sort of based on those Project Veritas guys that got arrested, but busted some of those stories wide open. And our fourth storyline, we have some actually physically presenting supernatural characters. So a couple of angels and a couple of demons running around and causing mischief. That's the supernatural, the sort of fantastical elements that I alluded to earlier. And we're trying to demonstrate with all of these storylines, not just that the issue of abortion is evil, because I don't even think that that's a serious question. I don't view that as a serious debate. But the deliberate and direct spiritual implications, shown in this case in a very artistic and fantastical way, that a lot of these things and our choices actually have. And
what are some of those spiritual implications to you?
So I will say that one of the characters that's a demon that we have running around is Moloch, the Moloch from ancient times in the Old Testament, sort of God worshipped with child sacrifice.
Yeah, that's right. Sacrifices for children right on the altar.
We also wanted to show, if not the literal reality, because some of the spiritual stuff, how we know for sure, but a lot of people have had experiences. We wanted to try and communicate the feeling, right? What does it feel like when you're being tempted, say, in a non-cheesy way? What does it feel like when you're having a dream and a nightmare and you have something attacking you, whispering things to you sort of in that sort of almost horror way, but not quite. I wouldn't consider the show horror, but when you're dealing with these sort of horrific things like the murder of children, we wanted to really push the envelope and actually show that, you know, as Christians, we have had some really great movies about the life of Christ, and I'm not complaining about that at all. But there's all these other stories in the Bible. There's all these other elements of our faith that would make really compelling art. And I don't know if it's just because people are afraid to touch them or it's hard, you know, it's a difficult thing. But we've spent many hours arguing with each other and writing things and coming back and forth as a team to try and get that right. But we want to encompass all of that because the groundwork has been laid, unplanned. The movie did very well. And obviously the biopic about Abby Johnson, and I thought for the most part that was pretty good. Those are actually the same guys that wrote Nefarious. But we want to take it a step further and say, yeah, okay, murdering children is bad, and here are some of the consequences of your actions. You open yourself up to maybe this slippery slope of choices and spiritual repercussions because of this thing that you did and this thing that you did and this thing that you did. That I think makes it really compelling, even though I would obviously say the show is pro-life. We're trying to explore how all this stuff kind of interweaves together.
So the curtain blinding us from that unseen dimension where the demons are, you're giving us a sneak peek, and that's one of four different narratives, and these narratives alternate throughout the episodes. You'll go to one, you'll jump to another.
Yep. Yeah. All interwoven. Despite some of the inappropriate content and the failing of the last several seasons, both Scott and I really enjoyed the first couple seasons of Game of Thrones. We've got this big cast of characters that are all sort of interwoven, but also kind of doing their own thing. It's not that big, but we tried to model it off of that. Or even, since you guys were talking about Star Wars, the end of Return of the Jedi, you have these different storylines. You've got Han Solo, and then you've got Luke, but they're all in the same story, just at different parts of the story, doing different things. So we tried to emulate that.
Speaking of inappropriate content, and this may sound like an unusual question, I'm not a believer in profanity as a Christian, and in movies, I think a lot of times it's gratuitous. But at the same time, a little bit of profanity can make a character seem realistic. Is this something that there'll be no profanity at all, or will there be a little amount used sparingly? What's your standard on that?
We've gone back and forth about that quite a bit. So here's what I'll say. I was in the Air Force for 12 years. I mean, my virgin years have never heard profanity, I can tell you. And I'm sure Nick would have the same experience as a cop, right? We have a friend. He wrote Sons of Thunder, Randall Reeder. And we love Randall. Randall's a great guy. We've worked with him in the past. He's been in movies like Deadpool. But he made this show for PureFlix called Sons of Thunder. And it's kind of like this, like, A-team style TV show where he was this biker and former special ops guy, and he's in with the wrong crowd, and then he gives his life over to Christ, and then he goes around A-team style throughout the show, saving people, helping people out. It's like, it's a great show. I'm not trying to badmouth Randall's show or anything like that, but like one of the most unrealistic aspects of it is he's dealing with these really hardcore bikers, and while the character himself has given his life over to Christ, and now he's trying to turn over this new leaf and do all these great things, he's dealing with these really gruff, rough kind of thug individuals, right? And it's just completely unbelievable to me that they're going to
be these rough bikers don't say shucks, darn, and dang?
Exactly. So is Kevin Sorbo's character going to be using gross profanity? No, because that doesn't fit his character. Are the demons running around going to use profanity? Yeah.
Does anybody hold funding over your head because of profanity? I'm with you. Artistically, I completely agree, but I'm just wondering if you're running into any brick walls with it.
No, it hasn't been too big of an issue. I would say that the show will probably, I mean, it's a show, not a movie, but I would consider the show right on the border of PG-13 or R, if that gives people sort of an idea.
Yeah, yeah.
There's not a ton of gratuitous profanity. We have some sort of implied other things, but you don't see anything. But
and if writing is creative enough, you really don't need that much of it.
Sure.
But yeah, I agree with you. Depending on who the character is, it could be ridiculous after a while.
But I will tell you, interestingly, what we've had issues with, we've had several people that could have financially helped, if not the whole show, then a great deal. And they were Christian professing, but they didn't want to touch the project because we're dealing with abortion. And they thought that it was going to be really controversial. And that...
Now, why were they wanting to avoid the controversy?
Yeah, right. That was far more disappointing to me than somebody being like, oh, I don't really like this bad word you put in here. Can we talk about that? Or, you know. But no, we haven't had too many issues. So I would say, yeah, there's... Probably some, but not a lot. And I agree with you. I think if it's, depending on the character, a little bit goes a long way. It's one of those things that if you do it all the time, you just desensitize people to it anyway, right? So it's the same thing as anything else. You don't want mindless violence all the time, even in your action movie. You want really good, tight, punctuated set pieces of action so that people really get invested and follow it. Whereas if the whole movie is just sort of gratuitous gore and violence, at some point your brain just checks out and you're like, yeah, I don't even care what happens. I think everything is the same, profanity, whatever, right? So
your company is called Sixpence Productions. What is the meaning of that title? Where does that come from?
Well, it comes from, you know, Scott's a historian, so I'm going to let him answer longer than mine. But basically it comes from, and our symbol is got the pine tree from the Appeal to Heaven flag, which actually I saw just ran into some controversy. I believe that Justice Alito was getting hemmed up because some of the news, quote unquote, news media found out that he had an Appeal to Heaven flag at his beach house or something. But Scott, if you want to elucidate on that.
So the pine tree flag, yeah, he's right about Justice Alito, and they're saying it's a dog whistle, but nothing could be further from the truth. The phrase itself, an appeal to heaven, comes right out of John Locke's Second Treatise of Government, where he posits the question, it's like, okay, we have these natural rights that God has given us as creatures made in his image that we are supposed to have as human beings. But what happens if you have a government that is trampling your rights? And, you know, you make your appeals to the government to respect your rights. And the purpose of government in the first place is to protect your rights. And all this is outlined beautifully in the Declaration of Independence, I would note. But Locke wrote it first. So who do you appeal to if you can't go to the magistrate, if you can't go to the judge or king or the parliament, and they're the ones that are trampling your rights? Well, there's always an appeal to heaven because God's law trumps the law of man. And so you will always have your justice delivered to you, at least at the end in judgment. And that's what Locke's.
Okay, well, gentlemen, you're fascinating guests, but we are running out of time in the seconds we have left. Where can people get a hold of you to contribute to this production and timetable? When can we expect to see this show on the air?
So quickly, we have an $8,000 price tag that we're trying to reach. We're trying to raise $8,000. So far, we've reached $2,000 of that $8,000. And with that $8,000, we're going to be able to make a 90-second trailer. And we have some really fabulously wealthy people that we have in mind to help bankroll this. People like Texas Right to Life has hooked us up with some of their donor base. So kudos to Texas Right to Life. If we can get this $8,000 raised and make this 90-second trailer, then we're going to be able to demonstrate to these people that could fund the whole entire thing.
Okay, a website where they can get a hold of you?
Go ahead,
Nick. GiveSendGo.com/highplaces, all spelled out.
Okay, what an honor to have both of you on our program. Hope you'll be back again really soon.
Thanks so much, Bob.
To be back. Thanks so much, Bob.
All right, we'll see you all next time.